We are taking the plunge to another Alaska frontier today, the underwater one. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. I can't even imagine what it takes to be a diver in Alaska, but all the divers I know are totally in love with it. Our number, 1-800-478-8255, to talk with our explorer guests. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk at alaskapublic.org. We go now to the remote Aleutian Islands and down, down, down on Talk of Alaska, statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Rasmussen Foundation announces a March 1st deadline to apply for individual artist awards, which provide funding directly to artists to support their creative work. Learn more by participating in one of their informational teleconferences to be held in January. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
It's being published now by the University of Alaska Press, and it is a large coffee table book with a lot of incredible pictures in it called Sea Life of the Aleutians and Underwater Exploration. Forward by Sylvia Earle, authors Reed Brewer, Heloise Chinello, Sean Harper, and Stephen Jewett, who joins us now. He is a research professor at University of Alaska Fairbanks Institute of Marine Science. Steve, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Well, good morning, Steve.
It's great to have you on the show and get a chance to hear some of your tales of diving in the Aleutians. I understand that, you know, you've been diving for, what, 40 years?
Yeah, close to it.
And you started in the Aleutians in the sometime in the last century.
Well, in 1992 was my first exposure to the Aleutians. I began diving in Alaska in 72, but it wasn't 20 years later that I really found an opportunity to get out in the Aleutians to do some probing out there. And since 92, been trying to get out there as much as possible.
Well, what is it that makes these so attractive for you as a scientist, as a diver, as an explorer?
Well, the Aleutians the region is unlike other areas of Alaska in that it has no major rivers, so no major sediment input. The visibility in the Aleutians is extraordinary. It's not uncommon to find visibility that'll approach 100 feet. And other areas in Alaska, it's not uncommon to find diving visibility of, you know, 10, 20, 30 feet at the most. So the Aleutians is extraordinary, but coupled with the visibility is the extraordinary biodiversity that we have out there. Most of the substrate is a hard substrate, and so the organisms that reside out there are, most of them are attached ones. So there's lush kelp forest and a whole host of other organisms that live in association with that kelp forest.
Now, I'm glad you brought that up because I've been reading, I think it's James Estes' work on the kelp forests and the sea otters, and we all know the sea otter population out there is decimated for reasons that are somewhat mysterious. But, that would probably, I would think, affect that kelp forest because you get a lot of sea urchins, and the sea urchins eat that kelp.
Well, this is true. When I first went out in 92, that mission was with Dr. Estes. And during that time, we were actually capturing sea otters. And in a 2 or 3 week mission, I think 100 otters were captured. And they were all captured within a small radius of around the south end of Amchitka Island. So in those days, the otter population was very high. Conversely, you go out there today, and you'll search throughout the Aleutians and have a hard time finding more than a dozen otters.
But the kelp forest, at least for now, there's still plenty of it, I guess.
There is, and so what you have is since the otters are no longer there, as you said, the urchin numbers are great. And with urchin greatness, you have a lot of grazing activity on the kelp. Well, it's the understory kelp that sort of gets hammered first. And when we talk about kelp beds or kelp forests, it's typically there's understory kelp or kelp that really just grows a short distance from the bottom. Then you have the canopy kelp, which in many cases is extend to the sea surface, and we often see a canopy from our boats. But it's the understory kelp that is hammered first by all these urchins, and of course they continue to graze on the canopy kelp. But there's no doubt that there's been some thinning in recent years that's occurred by all of these urchins, and in many cases, in many places rather, we'll see what we call urchin barrens, where there's nothing but urchins, just wall to wall urchins down there, and they essentially will marauding grazers that essentially will mow down everything in its path.
We need a fishery for them now. That's what we need.
Well, there is a fishery in some parts of Alaska.
I know. Out there would be a different scale, probably. Well, it must be challenging with the currents and all that, I would think. I mean, the surface conditions can be very stringent in the Aleutians. I would think undersea might be the same.
It is. The currents can be pretty stiff, especially as you do any diving around the passes. So a lot of the diving that we've done over the years, we essentially will look at the tides and locations, of course, and if we want to try to get in the water near a pass, then we'll try to plan that right around the slack waters or slack tides. And but once that tide starts to really motivate, then that's when we got to get out of the water.
So in your diving in the when you get around to this century in 2006, 2007, when you got to do basically all the way from Unimak Pass to Attu, which I would assume would be where a lot of these images came from, you reported all these new species that you found. I mean, this is just crazy. You were telling me that sea stars alone, there were 13 or 14 new species of sea stars that you found there. And this is just, this is some amazing diversity you're talking about.
Well, it is astounding, Steve, but and the reason I think that there's so many undiscovered species out there or newly discovered species is because it is so remote. Let's remember that area is 1,200 miles long. There's over 200 islands out there, and it's just a long way from Anchorage. So there's not a lot of activity out there that gets below the waterline. And so, for years and years and years, with the exception of Jim Estes and his students, there's not been too many people that have been able to dive out there. So to find new species is truly exciting for me. I went 35 years of diving and researching here in Alaska without finding one new species until we came to those Aleutian Islands.
And you've got like 40 in the book so far, and a bunch more likely to come, right? If people get time to do the research.
Well, we've published on 19, and we have probably another 30 to go.
Wow.
If we ever find the personnel and the money to really a lot of these pending new species are kelp species, kelp or algae species, and so it takes somebody with that expertise to pull it off. But nevertheless, we've made collections of things that aren't in any textbooks, that aren't in any taxonomic books, and we've been talking with experts around the world, and so there's a lot more to emerge. But thus far, over the last 3 years, we've published 19 new species. That includes 17 new sea stars, and a sea anemone, and a brown algae or a kelp.
Yeah, we're speaking with Stephen Jewett, research professor, University of Alaska Fairbanks, co-author of Sea Life of the Aleutians and Underwater Exploration. So is there more exploring to be done out there, Steve?
Well, I'd like to do some more exploring, but of course that always entails a great deal of funding. As you know, to get out there, having a vessel or a support vessel is very costly. It's not uncommon to, you know, to have to pay $10,000 a day for a vessel out there when you consider, especially when you're considering working in the Western Aleutians.
Okay, I'd like to turn to our second guest. I'll give the phone number, though, first, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage of 550-8422. Email is talk@alaskapublic.org. And our subject is the undersea Aleutians, but the undersea world, too, I guess. One of my favorite diving enthusiasts is with us, and that is Michelle Ridgway of the Alaska Deep Ocean Research Institute. Joins us by phone from Fairbanks. Why are you in Fairbanks, Michelle?
Hello, Steve.
Hi.
Well, I'm in Fairbanks, far from the ocean, for one reason. We have so much analysis to do from various dives, both in the Bering Sea and in the past from the Aleutians as well. So I'm here, brought specimens to various laboratories here, working with Nora Foster and other taxonomists to identify species collected by submersible and ROV from deep canyons. Also had a number of samples analyzed here at the isotope lab, looking at stable carbon and nitrogen isotopes and in the future oxygen isotopes to elucidate food web connections and look at past climate from some of the specimens we collected also in the slopes and canyons.
So you, when you say deep, how deep are you talking about in these canyons? I mean, Steve was telling me his dives go down to maybe 20 meters. How about you? You use a remote vehicle, as I understand?
Do when necessary. Of course, the ideal tool is a submersible. And Steve, when you're thinking about deep, it is entirely a matter of perspective. I mean, to put this into scale, you know, the deepest place in the world's oceans is in the vicinity of Challenger Deep, Marianas Trench, and that's over 10,000 meters, so over 35,000 feet. And in Alaska, our deepest place is in the Aleutian Trench, where we've yet to explore fully, that's for sure. And that's about 8,100 meters. The canyons that I've been working in on the Bering Slope are Zemchug and Pribilof, primarily, and their maximum depth is about 3,000 meters in the case of Zemchug, and about 2,700 meters. So how far have we explored? To what depth? Only a fraction of that depth at this point. By human-piloted submersibles, we've explored to about 600 meters, and deeper yet with ROVs down to about 1,200 meters. So less than half the full depth of some of these deep features in Alaska.
And you were telling me that nobody's exceeded Picard?
Oh, well, Jacques Picard and Don Walsh made the deepest dive ever in a human-piloted submersible.
I think I was a kid when this happened.
Oh, were you? Well, 1960.
Yeah.
Jacques Picard and Don Walsh in the Trieste dived in Challenger Deep, stayed a few hours and returned over 50 years ago, and that's not been repeated. There are not many subs that can go to these depths. In fact, on the U.S., the sort of starship of the U.S. submersible research fleet is Alvin, and Alvin has been to Alaska in the past, briefly, unfortunately, and her maximum depth is 4,500 meters. So we don't even have the tools, really, to go to those depths, except for our collaborations with other nations that have deeper diving research subs.
Oh, my. You're not going to tell me it's the Russians, are you?
I'm not going to tell you.
Okay.
Well, I will tell you, however, that some of the finest submersibles in the world were designed and built by the Finns, and we have some of those in the U.S. research fleet, the Pisces, for example. Japanese have Finnish-built subs as well.
Yeah, that makes me feel a little better because the Russian icebreakers are mostly built in Finland anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's a great tale that I'd like to get on the air someday of how they made the decision to develop that industry, and now they just lead the world by far. They're just the go-to place for this type of craft.
They are, but hopefully that will change. I would really love to see us in Alaska develop our own deep-sea technology that is built for Alaskan conditions and accessible by both the research and education community. I certainly would like to have a home-ported sub ideally built here by our fine engineering minds that work in the Arctic and as well as places like Steve out in the Aleutians to handle the strong currents, the deep cold, et cetera, because I think we can do just as well as the Finns when we put our minds to it.
Yeah. So, Michelle, I believe you have a few new species to your credit as well.
Well, we're working on them. We have quite a collection, and as Steve noted earlier, it takes quite a long while to work through the taxonomy. Nora Foster has been working with an Epistobranch that does certainly appear to be a new species from Zemchug Canyon, and that's quite exciting. We have a few steps to go in working on this, possibly a species of an 11-rayed sea star. This is a brilliant orange sea star that can be nearly a meter across with hollow appendages, so these hollow legs. It looks like a puppet or a Cirque du Soleil figure that walks across the soft, deep canyon floors, and that may be an Astrocles, maybe a new genus. We're working on that as well. And we certainly had dozens of range extensions identified, meaning identifying species that were thought to exist in California or only as far north as the Gulf of Alaska, which have been now found on the deep slopes in these canyons in the Bering Sea.
Now, you do, I think, have kind of a slideshow or something in your on your website, Alaska Deep Ocean. And could we see, if we went there, could we see some of these critters like this spidery sea star you found?
Oh, certainly. You can see images of Astrocles and the Opisthobranchs and the many new sponges that Helmut is working on, Helmut Lenhardt, and others, maps, images, and we'll be posting some video clips online as well.
Have you ever done the Aleutian Trench?
Not yet. It's on the in the planning stages. There's an exceptionally interesting canyon in the Aleutians that we've been looking at, pulling together multi-beam data for. And that's off the western end of Kiska Island is a vast canyon called Murray Canyon. And it actually connects across the Aleutians down into the Aleutian Trench. And that is on our dive schedule for the future, and hopefully sooner rather than later. We also hope to certainly dive in the deepest part of the Aleutian Trench, which is located further to the east near Kodiak.
Steve Jewett, when you did your transect in the Aleutians, did you experience that area there?
We didn't have any stations. We had some stations on both sides of that, but, of course, nothing that ever got into the canyon. As I said, 20 meters is about our cutoff depth for diving, but that'd be an exciting region. Get some samples.
Well,
take
you
a look.
This is I understand these waters, very clear waters. You got a hard bottom for the most part. So, as you were saying, you have this great visibility, and I guess also the Aleutian Trench gives rise to to upwelling.
It certainly does. More of the upwelling occurs on the south side of the Aleutians than on the north side. It's much deeper water on the south side than the northern side. But there's no doubt that there's probably different regions of the Aleutians that has greater upwelling than others. So I really am not very knowledgeable about the upwelled regions.
Yeah, Michelle, basically the theory on upwelling, of course, is you get you get a good plankton bloom often out of that, right?
Plankton bloom and otherwise, yes. And it's a really important point, and one that we're focusing on quite a bit in the canyons, which is that despite the vast depths, the entire system from deep to quite shallow, from the photosynthetic zone to possibly the deep chemosynthetic zone, they're intimately connected ecologically through food web, especially some of the species are literally transporting carbon through diurnal migrations. And as Sylvia Earle loves to say, the greatest migration on Earth is what? It's the daily vertical migration in the water column of so many species, from squid to zooplankton and the lesser known species such as ketic gnats. These organisms move thousands of meters every day and are both carrying production up into the water column, as well as foraging in the illuminated plankton zone or foraging even on kelp carbon and then descending. And these migrations are for various reasons. They may be ascending to avoid predation or to predate, and for various other ontogenetic reasons, species are moving up and down. And we then have the advection and upwelling of deep sea currents, which is so important for providing fresh nutrients, nitrogen, phosphorus. The work of Phyllis Stabenow and Terry Whitledge and so many others have demonstrated the clear connection through that upwelling to feeding the phytoplankton blooms, as well as the attached kelp species in places like the Aleutians.
And you said chemosynthetic.
I did.
So yeah. Non-photosynthetic. So these, what's going on with this?
Well, that's exactly the question, and it's a question that's been addressed in quite a bit of detail at so many sites, like the seafloor spreading zones in the Atlantic that have been so well studied, where hot sulfide gases are being released. Well, in colder areas and in Alaska, there are vast deposits of methane hydrate under the seafloor. The work of David Scholl and others has shown that there are huge deposits of methane hydrate. Is basically a methane molecule frozen in ice crystals and under the seabed. So there are places where these methane hydrates are exposed to the seafloor, and some bacteria are highly specialized. They're called methanotrophic bacteria in utilizing the energy from methane hydrate to produce energy, and they then feed a unique food web, which has, again, been studied in quite a few places, Gulf of Mexico among them. But we're starting to try to examine that through isotopes and through other means to see what I'm kind of trying to look at the total carbon provisioning of these ecosystems, both from phytoplankton and kelp up in the photosynthetic zone and from chemosynthetic processes in the deep. It may be that part of the reason Alaska remains so productive is that there is a sort of a provisioning of energy from the deep. I kind of call this my alternative energy hypothesis, and we're trying to determine to what extent that may be occurring and helping to stabilize and maintain the high level of production we do observe here.
Completely wild. Michelle Ridgway of the Alaska Deep Ocean Research Institute, analyzing her specimens in Fairbanks. Also with us, Stephen Jewett, research professor at UAF, who is co-author of the book Sea Life of the Aleutians and Underwater Exploration. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, to talk with our explorers. That's a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk at alaskapublic.org. We had one caller who got tired of waiting here, but I'll ask a question that he passed on, Steve Jewett. Did you explore any of the World War II stuff that exists, I guess, off of Kiska and some other places?
Well, none of our study sites were right in and around those areas. However, in 2004, we were around Kiska and doing some sampling there, and we did find, an awful lot of debris on land, two-man subs, Japanese two-man subs, as well as a number of artillery that's still in place on Little Kiska and Kiska, number of ships that have been sunk during World War II that are in Kiska Harbor. There's another ship or two ships that's out in Kiska Bay that are certainly diveable. We didn't go inside of any of those wrecks. We've dove on them. We've seen them. But there's an awful lot of World War II material that's around all of these sites. It's not uncommon to find lots of ammunition, casings of ammunition. Some of them are expended. Others that are just as I said, the casings. We found this last summer when I was at ADAC, we found a number of World War II artifacts. We simply left them in place.
Yeah, we had a really fascinating show about all the stuff that was left behind on Kiska. And I guess there are still some mysteries there. And do you know if there's been any diving archaeology done out there to start unraveling some of those mysteries?
I don't, Steve. It'd be a fun project to do. Since you've got that great visibility. Although Kiska Bay does have a lot of soft sediments, and so it doesn't take too much mucking around down there before you stir things up and the lights go out, so to speak.
Let's go to Roger, joins the program from White Mountain, talking about currents. Roger, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yeah, good morning. Great topic. I got a short comment and a one question. An interesting area to look for anything would be where scientists call the Beringia Land Bridge. Imagine what you can find there or not find there. My question is there any plans to dive in that part of the Bering Sea? I'll hang up and listen to your response. Thank you.
All right. Either one of you want to try this? Steve Jewett?
Well, I don't have any plans or know of any plans to do any scuba diving in that region. I will add that a number of years ago, in fact, back in the 70s, when I was doing some OCCEP trawling in the Bering Strait, we trawled up the trawl snagged a large chunk of the seabed and brought up a big cluster of peat material. Well, in that peat was woolly mammoth remains. We had a tusk and several teeth. So pretty solid evidence that Bering Sea bridge was in place long, long ago. So it'd be a fascinating area to be able to dive. Unfortunately, the currents and the visibility is probably going to limit any scuba activity.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have been there, and we're going to return to Beringia, especially the southern margin. A very unexpected find during our dives in 2007 in Pribilof Canyon were these bizarre sedimentary round objects. They, at first, while I was underwater, I thought they were geodes or something. I couldn't tell, but there was an entire field of these clods. Well, I brought them to the surface and then waited nearly 6 months before finally opening them, and I didn't even open them. I actually went down to the hospital and borrowed a X-ray machine and to determine what was inside, so we didn't damage what might have been within the center of these things. It ends up that each one had a full-size gastropod shell, so a big snail. Okay, well, we took those snails, and I worked with Nora Foster, who identified these species. One is existing, one does not. Had them radiocarbon dated, and the dates from those were between 13,000 and 14,000 years ago. And where I collected them was the area that was just slightly deeper than the deepest low water level during the last glacial maximum at the southern edge of Beringia. So it might have been what you call the beach of Beringia. And over time, over the last 3 years, Nora and others and I have been looking into this, and come to find out those species of gastropods were commonly used by migrating people globally. And there are large middens in the Aleutian Islands with those species where people were living tens of thousands of years ago. But we're now using stable oxygen to determine the water temperature in this beach area and sort of doing a reconstruction of what is now an undersea massive canyon, but what was then one of the probably richest, most productive estuarine bays along southern Beringia. So if people were in the vicinity, like all of us, where do we go for shelter? We go to bays. And would you want to hunt a mastodon for your dinner, or might it be easier to, you know, anchor your kayak in a bay and get kelp and clams and salmon? The Kuskokwim River used to flow into Pribilof Canyon during the ice ages intermittently. So we know that it appears that it was a rich area, and no, we haven't seen fire rings or signs of people, but I have seen and have mapped undersea beach ridges, and we'll just keep looking around in that vicinity at those depths and see if we might find other clues possibly.
You guys are really taking this to all these new worlds. It's just absolutely fascinating radio to me as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. AlaskaPublic.org, connecting you to Alaska, one story at a time.
Well, we're talking about Alaska's undersea frontier, and we're discovering it's barely explored. We got two of the foremost explorers with us, Steve Jewett and Michelle Ridgway, and we've strayed from the Aleutians on up into the Pribilof Canyon, and I want to get back to the Aleutians, but first, Michelle, have you had any discussions with Steve Mashner and Herb Mashner and about his archaeology out in the Aleutians where he's been documenting the human occupation for 30,000 years?
Well, I haven't spoken with him directly. He was at a recent meeting, but I didn't catch up with him per se. This is not my field. And as an ecologist, I've been trying to do what I could to help develop this reconstruction. And then the likes of Don Johansson and others have developed a keen interest in this area, certainly Jim Dixon and other archaeologists and anthropologists have been looking into this. But I haven't spoken with Mashner directly about this, but I have looked at some of his species lists for species they're identifying in the middens.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, it sounds like we just got another show is what we got. Because this whole business of exploring under the sea for the signs of humans and how early they might have been here, that's a huge field, I think. And so much we don't know. Maybe you have any light to shed on this, Steve Jewett?
Oh, nothing from a human perspective. There's some interesting books that whenever I'm out at sea, I'm always going to the library and grabbing a book off the shelf there. And I think there was one that came out in the last decade on finding some Aleut remains on some of the islands and buried in some of the caves, and very, very interesting to me to learn more about that. But
I want to take you then out to that area you told me about, the four mountains.
Certainly.
Where you see volcanic activity and kind of a different kind of ecology going on. Maybe you could talk about that a bit.
Yeah, well, everyone knows that the Aleutians is quite dynamic area, dynamic zone. It's part of the Ring of Fire, and it's not uncommon to have an earthquake out there daily.
Well, I mean, we just had the Casatochi blow, what, 3 years ago or so?
That's right. And in August of 2008, it blew and totally decimated it. But there's another, well, the whole region is exciting from that standpoint. But the island of Four Mountains is a, in my view, a truly unique area with four active volcanoes. And one on Mount Cleveland is belching gases almost daily. And when we were out there in 2006 and 2007, it was poofing out black smoke all the time. And but we found some unique areas around Cagamel Island. Cagamel is one of those island of Four Mountains, and it has a lot of fumaroles that are evident. So as any ship will steam by, you'll see these smokestacks that are coming off the island. Well, they're simply thermal vents. With a lot of sulfur and who knows what else associated with it. Well, we had some of our dive sites not too far from one of these fumaroles that was really giving off a lot of smoke and gases. And so we wanted to see what was below the waterline. So we jumped in, and, it was just amazing with all of the bubbles that were emerging from the substrate in that zone. It was like diving in a can of ginger ale that you just opened up, and there were bubbles coming up everywhere, and we found a couple of fairly large openings where some hot water was just really flowing profusely, and it was around 100 degree water. And one of our new kelp species actually came from that zone, and we called it the Golden V kelp, and we need to do some more analyses on this kelp because I suspect that the yellow or the golden coloration that's in that particular kelp has some sulfur compounds in it.
Would that surprise you, Michelle?
If the golden were from the sulfur, no. Is the species likely associated with the geochemistry that's unique to those volcanic islands? Probably yes. I think that they're definitely on to something. The only other location that kelp has been found is on St. George Island, and there's a lot of it around that rock. And there are some suspected vents in that vicinity as well. So it's definitely seems to be associated with the biogeochemistry that's very, very specific. And I think that when they found this and made these postulations, it got a lot of people thinking and agreeing that that's likely the case.
Wow. So what's holding it up? Why don't we know more about this yet, Steve?
Well, it takes money, unfortunately. Our study ended in 2007 out there, we've been talking with a number of faculty that are wanting to put together a proposal to go back out to the island of Four Mountains to do some work relative to ocean acidification. There's a good likelihood that the vast amount of gases that are coming into that environment there—it's probably changing the pH greatly, and be nice to take a deeper look and find out, exactly what's going on regarding those gases. One of that kelp species that I mentioned earlier is we found no grazers on it, which means it was apparently resistant to anything feeding on it. We found no urchins that would touch it, no amphipods, nothing else that was grazing the base of it, and it was essentially pristine. So be nice to take a chemical look at that particular species to find out if it does have some unique properties that might be very interesting to the pharmaceutical industry.
Wow. I got a note from Bruce Wright, who we had on the show a couple of times, a senior scientist with Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association, who says increases in ocean acid levels are reported to be changing ocean chemistry, especially in the Aleutians. Do you see changes or any effects from these changes in ocean chemistry?
I haven't seen anything that shows it, but I certainly expect it to be happening. The hard substrate that's out there is mostly encased in coral and encrusting coral and algae, and certainly that has a composition that would make it very difficult to withstand in a high acid environment. So I suspect that if you see ocean acidification being elevated in that region, then that encrusting coral and algae would be the first one to go or to be impacted in some way.
Is that an aragonite situation, or is that I understand that it's like two levels of effect on the calcium. One of them is like the pteropods and things like that, but for a lot of the corals, it's actually aragonite. It'd have to be quite a bit more acid to really have an effect. Do I have that right?
I don't know, Steve. You're probably right, but I'm hoping to deal with some of my colleagues here. Jeremy, Dr. Mathis is.
Yeah, well, I think what I was thinking is I can't quite remember how vulnerable coralline algae are. Michelle, do you know?
How vulnerable? I think that not nearly so much as the aragonite-based primnoas and some of these other corals. And Steve was just referencing Dr. Jeremy Mathis and his work, and I've spoken to him in the past about the issue regarding where are these saturation horizons for calcite and aragonite that may affect the zooplankton you mentioned, like pteropods, as well as some of the benthic obligate cnidarians like the corals. And there's a lot of questions yet remaining about pH levels and the degree to which they change at depth. There's some speculation that corrosive waters are advecting from the deep, and yet we're really hard-pressed to put together enough empirical data to really know. So on our next dives, we'll be collecting water samples and tissue samples at depth to try to examine what the baseline is in terms of pH level and how well or poorly some of these species are doing that environment.
Jeremy was explaining, we had him on the show some time ago, and he was explaining that it's a different sort of test to get the pH to where it means anything,
right,
and that they just haven't really been geared up for that. But he's trying to get them geared up.
Yes. He and Dr. Dick Feely with NOAA are working overtime, and their entire teams are working very hard to try to get after this issue. But when you sort of focus out in thinking about this, one thing we find in the canyons is that, and it's clear over evolutionary time, there are species that have evolved to deal with a wide variety of pH environments. For example, some corals don't have the aragonite skeletons that others have. Some corals have no skeleton at all, and some zooplankton species have no hard parts, like ketognaths. Therefore, they're not as directly affected by a change in their ability to sequester calcium carbonate from the water column.
Well, I brought that up to somebody. Says, they got laboratory tests that show these corals survive just fine stark naked. And he said, yeah, well, how long do you think they'll outlast predation, though?
Right.
It's a little different when you get it in the field. Yeah, it's Talk of Alaska, and we have a call from Homer. Pat, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yeah, hi, Steve. It's Pat McBride here in Homer.
Hi, Patrick.
I'm a commercial fisherman, and I've been involved in the Aleutians for the past 25 years with a longline vessel, the Judy B. And through the years, we've been from Zemchuk Canyon up in the northern Bering Sea all the way out to Murray Canyon and in the Stalemate Banks, just past Attu to the Russian border, fishing black cod mostly. And that's in a depth from 300 to 500 fathoms, which is right around 1,000 meters or less. But anyway, I'm just wondering how involved all the scientific community has been involved with fishermen like myself, because there's a fair amount of guys that that spend a lot of time out there, like myself, that understand the currents in the bottom and the bottom samples all throughout the Aleutians that, you know, could probably be very helpful to these people if we could all be on the same page and help one another.
My first exposure to Aleutian Island corals was through fishermen. I dived out in the Aleutians starting in 1986 and had never dived deep enough to see corals and was mostly focusing on kelp beds and other nearshore environments for some of the reasons Jewett has mentioned, that currents are extremely high. But quite a few longliners kept saying, we're finding these corals. We're finding huge corals in vast amounts, and we're really interested to know what species they are. So I flew out to ADAC and met with some fishermen, and they brought all these specimens in. It was just tremendous, and they were extremely informative about what was going on out there, and that helped spur some of the research which occurred over the following decade under the Essential Fish Habitat funding scenario that Senator Stevens helped make sure was funded. And eventually that led to some protections of some very, very modestly sized coral gardens, which were found to have very high diversity of these corals. But in answer to your question, at every opportunity I try to work with fishermen, they usually are extremely informative about where and how I might be able to maneuver the sub in diving scenarios. I do have some great shots of black cods feeding in Zemchug Canyon, so I'll have to get your number afterwards and send you some video of your prized species in situ eating myctophids for lunch.
How's that, Pat?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think, local knowledge, I think, is always valuable. I think with, using the Internet, we probably have a greater potential now to pool some of our knowledge here. Steve Jewett, I imagine you value local knowledge.
Well, I certainly do. Like Michelle, my first encounter with coral came via a fisherman when I was working in Kodiak for Alaska Department of Fish and Game. We had some fishermen that brought in some coral, and they had dragged it up and wanted to know what it was. And so it's always interesting to talk to them, find out exactly where they got it. And of course, there's always the worry, I suspect, on the behalf of the fishermen that if you give them known information or information on where they fished, it may someday be closed down because it is so essential.
Well, I think that's what Michelle was telling us about, as a matter of fact. Pat, does that make you nervous?
Most definitely. It makes every fisherman nervous. But, there has to be some way that all of us can collaborate on all that to be for the better good of everyone. But, immediately, a lot of the fishermen in the ADAC area and that sort of thing, got a bad taste in their mouth because right after that, then there's all these coral gardens declared in places that closed down our fishing areas. And we're not interested in closing down our fishing areas, but we are interested in trying to solve what's going on. I mean, you look at the space program today and you see the money that's spent on space and people wanting to go to Mars, and we don't even know what lies in the bottom of the Aleutians, which is a major food source for the world. And that's the kind of thing that kind of gets in a lot of our craw, of course, and a whole other subject. I don't need to go there, but I just do want to express that, there's a number of people like me that have spent a lot of years out there. And as we go across the bottom from border to border, Zemchug Canyon, Russian border versus Murray Canyon and Stalemate Banks, the other Russian border of Alaska, and traveling that bottom with hooks, we get a pretty good sample of what that bottom looks like, whether like the Zemchug Canyon is pretty much, as far as we're concerned, a muddy, not very exciting bottom, whereas you go to the south side of the Pacifics from Seaguam to Kiska, Murray Canyon, I mean, it's an underwater garden of coral and every source of marine life, which always brings me back to the whole thing that they miss when the hot topics that you've had through the months and years, Steve, with the Pebble Mine, everybody speaks of how it's going to destroy the Bristol Bay fishery. But what they don't realize is that that whole estuary of rivers that comes into Bristol Bay is what feeds the entire Bering Sea. And without that oxygenated water and estuary system that comes out of Bristol Bay, you don't have any Bering Sea plankton and such. So that would be the last point that I'd like to make, but I'd love to be in better touch with these people.
All right, Pat, thank you. And we'll go ahead and pass your number on to Michelle. You guys can talk to one another amongst yourselves as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. Every Alaskan can make a difference when we file online for our PFD. You can shelter families in crisis, nourish the hungry and homeless, and protect those who have suffered abuse and neglect. And it's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. Good things will happen for the causes you care about. This message sponsored by ConocoPhillips Alaska and Mattsu Health Foundation.
Well, we were just chatting with a fisherman who long lines for black cod out there in the Aleutians, and Michelle, he was kind of bad mouthing your Zemchuk Canyon, calling it boring.
He did. Well, Pat, I could tell you, I have looked at a lot of sedimentary plains down there, but there is something that was again very unexpected, very exciting. There are these little oases out there in Zemchuk Canyon, and they are in fact due to the latitudinal position of the canyon, such that the seasonal Arctic sea ice comes down every year, nearly every year, covers at least a quarter of the head of Zemchuk Canyon and possibly more, and in past times probably a lot more. So, yes, Pat, cruising along in the sub, on the seafloor in Zemchuk, pretty flat. Lots of life, however, teeming with life, because the oceanography in that area is such that it is very, very rich. However, there wasn't much in the way of large organisms until we come across these massive stones that can be anywhere from a half meter to 2 meter diameter. Well, these drop stones are delivered by this sea ice conveyor belt probably every year, depending upon the sea ice thickness.
Now, where's the sea ice getting rocks?
The sea ice is freezing rocks as it's forming up in the north along the shores of Russia, along the shores of St. Lawrence Island.
Really?
And everyone that's been out on the sea ice, you see these rocks frozen in ice, and then as ice advances in its form, many rocks and lots of gravel are carried through this ice conveyor. And when the spring melt occurs, the rocks drop, and these rocks become these massive anchors for larger life forms that require kind of an anchoring habitat or hard substrate, like corals. So then you get corals settling on these and other organisms associated with the corals, and you have a small sort of forest habitat, if you will, and on and on. And there's some of them that are very highly evolved that have probably been down on the bottom of Zemchuk and Pribilof and other canyons for quite a long while, and others that did not appear to have much life. Maybe they're fairly recent. So those sort of the seafloor studded with these stones does make it more interesting. But their new multi-beam mapping of that area also shows that there are some pretty interesting walls, and we hope to get to the walls up to the eastern side of Zemchuk Canyon. Rupert and others from NOAA have looked at some of the pinnacles on the far eastern side of Zemchuk Canyon and found some fascinating rockfish habitat there. So there are some features, but yes, it's the largest undersea canyon in the world, and it was most likely formed by the role of Yukon River flowing off that slope in the past. So there is a lot of sediment deposited in it, and that sedimentary process continues even today. So,
yeah, you know, I was amazed to find out that we don't even know what the bottom of the ocean looks like in the Arctic Ocean, because there's ice over it all the time. And they go out there with the Healy and madly map away, you know, because there's law of the sea stuff at stake. It's just amazing. Steve Jewett, we're running out of time. I wanted to get you to talk a little bit about what's next for you in your diving life.
Well, I've got a diving project starting this summer up in Norton Sound. That's all relative to the offshore placer mining industry. And so there's going to be some... There's going to be a lot of activity in offshore Nome region here over the next couple of years, and so I plan to go back up there and reoccupy some of my stations that I occupied 20 years ago, and do some more studies.
Has it been that long since they hauled that dredge out of there?
It was.
Oh my God! You're making me feel old.
The Bema was history, and I guess it was around 1992.
Well, the price of gold's a lot higher now.
It is, and a lot of activity, a lot of interest, and so we want to make certain the environmental work is adequate before people go out there and do more mining in that.
Yeah, I would think there could be some nervousness about mercury.
That's certainly one of the concerns. The king crab fishery, it's the furthest north king crab fishery.
Oh, and they're good crab, too. They are really good crab.
But I just finished up a study in the Aleutians that everything is pending on it. We went back to the island of Amchitka. Amchitka, as many of our listeners know, was the site of three nuclear detonations back in the mid-60s to the early 70s. And in 2004, we took a team out, collected a bunch of plants and animals, and now this year we went back to repeat that and take another look, collected the same plants and animals, and all of those samples are being analyzed as we speak down at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. So hopefully here in the next within the next year, we'll be able to report to the public what the radionuclide levels are, and hopefully we can report that they are zero and it's not a concern. But nevertheless, because the whole region is so seismically active, and we know that we have radioactive material in those three shot cavities, that monitoring is essential for that area.
All right, thank you. No book tour then, I guess, huh?
I guess not at the moment. we do have one more book coming out this next year on Sea Stars of the Aleutians.
Oh, man, that is great. Thank you so much, Steve Jewett. Michelle Ridgway, are you going to get kids down in a submarine someday?
Well, I am working on that as we speak. This year, we'll be back up at the Pribilofs with an AUV and ROV if all goes well. And, yes, continue to work every day on getting our sub dives funded and having Alaskan students involved to the extent possible. Hopefully we'll have some on deck for our next dives in Pribilof and possibly Zemchug Canyon. And our new quest, next quest, is Barrow Canyon.
All right. Thank you. Time's up. Thank you so much for Dave Waldron and Josh Edge. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Every Alaskan can make a difference when we file online for our PFD. You can shelter families in crisis, nourish the hungry and homeless, and protect those who have suffered abuse and neglect. And it's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. And good things will happen for the causes you care about. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and BP. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.